In May of last year, Stephen Harper was reelected with a majority conservative government. 9 months later, the federal government has introduced many cuts that weren't part of the election campaign to government departments, public services, and the Canadian Wheat Board. The government is saying that more cuts are coming in the upcoming budget and potentially in the next few years, and this may include cuts to old age security and to public sector pensions. Julie Gard teaches labor studies and coordinates the labor studies program at the University of Manitoba. She's active in the women's labor and anti-war movements and joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Julie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Since the May election, the Conservative government has undermined Canadian workers. And I want to start by talking about union workers and their ability to bargain collectively, most notably in the Canada Post lockout and the Air Canada strike mm-hmm. last summer. Is the interference by this government different from what you'd expect from a government during a private labor issue?
It was quite remarkable. People across the country were just shocked by what Harper had done. It's unprecedented, of course, in Canadian history for a government to do what Harper did, to intervene in these two labor disputes. And I know people tend to think of the Canada Post labor dispute as a strike, and of course, you know, that's so wrong, and that's exactly what the union was trying to avoid. They were trying not to disrupt service to Canadians while still making their point with the employer. But, Harper intervened, and it was, it's in a way that was completely unexpected. And, this seems to me to be a very targeted intervention, because the postal workers have a long history of being one of the most militant unions in Canada. And for public sector workers, they've really set the standard for a lot of collective agreements. So the kinds of wage gains and maternity leaves and other kinds of provisions that other unionized workers have been able to get and that have filtered down to some extent to non-unionized workers have really been historically because of the gains made by postal workers. So I think this was a very, very strategic intervention against a union that had really been on the cutting edge of labor militancy and of gains for workers for decades and decades. So it was really quite shocking. And then the case of the Air Canada workers, possibly even more shocking, because the government declared that it was going to order them back to work even before they'd gone on strike. Such a thing has never happened in Canadian history, and it hasn't even happened in the United States. So it's really extraordinary, although possibly not unexpected with this particular government.
Are other workers, given what's happened, and especially public sector workers, are they going to feel that they can negotiate with their employer in good faith, given the interference by the government?
It really establishes a chill, and I think that this is not by any means an accident. This government has many things that we might say about it, good and bad, but one thing about them is that they're very good strategists. So they really, I think, plan these things carefully. And it's the signal has been sent to public sector workers that the government will intervene in ways that we really don't expect government to do, and in fact, contradict the federal government's legal obligation to foster and encourage collective bargaining. It's not just that they're supposed to be neutral. They actually have a moral and legal obligation to encourage free collective bargaining. And they've sent a message that they're not going to do that, that they're going to intervene on the side of the employers.
As well as these specific attacks against unionized workers, there has been cuts that are broader that we've talked about on this show that affect or potentially affect all Canadians or all Canadian workers, and things like the cuts to Canada Service Centres, where people who are applying for things like EI or CPP now have longer waits and are maybe less able to get benefits. Are Canadian unions able to organize outside of their membership to fight back against some of the more broad attacks against Canadians or Canadian workers?
Well, I guess the answer is that I hope so. Unions certainly have a long history of doing precisely that. We had the Days of Action not that long ago. We've had a number of general strikes. We've had union coalitions with community organizations across Canada in various ways, not just in the past, but also recently. Unions have, in fact, sort of pulled back in the last few decades, and much to their detriment. Now, partly this is because of the deindustrialization and the attack on organized labor, and it's understandable, I think, in a defensive posture. However, of course, unions really have, their strength has always been in their ability to mobilize broadly across the community. So we look forward to more unions being more courageous, sometimes pushing back against members who are a bit nervous about those kinds of things, who want to see their unions deliver services to them rather than go out on picket lines and engage in protests. But of course, that is the only way that we're going to get changes. And historically, working people have only got improvements from government when they've been willing to go out on the streets and demand them, because legislators don't wake up in the morning, even if they're nice people, and say, well, what will I give to the working people today? Because we're not a powerful lobby. So we really need to get that kind of message out strongly and forcefully and repeatedly out on the streets.
Are there tactics that we haven't seen in commonly in a while, things like wildcat strikes, that maybe should become more common or will become more common given the attacks of the Conservative government?
Well, I think creativity is really critical here, not just because it's an opportunity to do something and it's a way to speak to a government that's quite clearly not listening to us, but also because they're newsworthy, and it's very important to have media support when one does these kinds of things collectively, and also because they're kind of fun. I think about when the recession hit in places like France, and they were closing factories and other kinds of workplaces, and the workers there innovated the idea of boss napping. So they would kidnap bosses of workplaces that were about to close with no severance pay or little severance pay and no notice and so on, those kinds of things. And they would refuse to release the boss until their demands were met. And I think it was a little bit in fun. I mean, it wasn't like a serious kidnapping, but it was a really clever and interesting ploy, and it got a lot of news. And I think those kinds of things really do work. They worked for the workers in France. So it's the kind of thing that, I mean, obviously, you know, one has to not do things that are, you know, illegal, or at least should try not to do things that are illegal, only very marginally illegal. But you have to do things that are creative, that actually engage people and that enable them to do things in ways that they think are kind of fun and action oriented, and that, you know, you can do it with a sort of a spirit of enthusiasm. There's you don't want to go out on picket lines and spend months and months looking miserable and you know, be beaten down. You want to do things that are creative and involve street theater and those kinds of things, because these things actually work.
One thing I wanted to talk about, which has been in the news a lot lately, is the possible cuts to old age security, which have been hinted at fairly strongly by the government, which may or may not include raising the eligibility age from 65 to age 67, and may or may not come by 2020 or 2025. We've recently talked on the program about how the alternatives that the government is pushing, things like pooled private plans, are unrealistic for most Canadians. What would be the impact of raising the retirement age on low-income Canadian workers?
Well, it's hard to know exactly how that would happen, particularly when we're talking about years in advance. But it seems to be a move very much in the wrong direction. Canada has, quite remarkably, among OECD countries, done really, really well on reducing and, like, not quite eliminating, but coming very close to eliminating poverty among seniors. And that's specifically because of our public pension plans. Most people do not have employer-provided pension plans, and most people cannot contribute very much or anything at all to their RRSPs. So it's very difficult. There's just not enough money in people's lives to do that. So in order to eliminate or reduce seniors' poverty, we have to have a generous public pension program. And although Canada's isn't as generous as it should be, it doesn't bring people into a level that they could live comfortably if all they have is pensions, a public pension. Poverty has been reduced from the 1970s, when it was at 30%, to under 5% among seniors in Canada. And this is really remarkable. I think people across the world, when they look at these figures, are very surprised, because it's such a positive development. Senior poverty is a chronic problem. And in Canada, we have made big steps towards solving that problem. We still have some seniors living in poverty, obviously, but far, far fewer than in the past, and far fewer than many, many other countries. So why we would move backwards on this, seems it's hard to imagine why we would want to end or even tamper with or minimize such a very successful program that has done such good things for our community and, of course, for our seniors, people who we think well of. These are our elders. These are the people we would want to support. These are the people we will soon be. So, of course, it's very important to keep that going. So it's puzzling why the government do this. And, you know, I really can't understand that idea, unless it's just that they want to give more money to rich corporations because they believe that this will grow the economy. It seems unlikely.
And there are hints that they do like giving money to corporations, definitely. In terms of seniors in poverty, and I don't know the exact numbers, but from what I've seen, it's often women are still more likely to be in poverty if they're seniors. And are women less likely to have alternatives to OAS, such as a regular job that pays CPP benefits, or an employer with another pension plan?
Oh, absolutely. Women are far and away the largest group of seniors who live in poverty. So while we have made huge steps in only 3 or 4 decades towards almost eliminating or very much reducing seniors' poverty, the one group that is still at risk is senior single women. Women who we hear stories about even people who want to live as a couple but can't afford to, because of course your benefit is reduced significantly from about $1,200 to about $800 if you live together as a couple. And women are of course the ones who are most likely to be affected by this, and they still continue to live longer than men. So they do suffer, and it's something that really does need to be addressed. So we should be moving in that direction. There was a time when we were, all concerned about improving our social programs in Canada, and now we seem to be on the defensive and just trying to salvage, the remnants of what we have. I think actually it is important for us to push for improvements and not succumb to the idea that the sky is falling and there's nothing we can do and there is no money. GDP in Canada is doing very well. We are a rich country. There's plenty of money to go around. So there's no reason for us to take these cuts and to see seniors live in poverty, even if it's a smaller number than before.
And I imagine, with our economy as well, there are a lot more jobs now than there used to be that are, temporary or contract work. And with Harper's economic policy, a lot of what he seems to be pushing is jobs in the energy industries, which, may be well-paying jobs, but they're also, they can be quite dangerous work. They may be physically demanding. So you may have workers that, a lot more people who are going to rely on some sort of support because they're going to, become injured in the future or not be able to work at their current job or their job won't exist at some time. What do you think, organized labor as well as other groups need to do to push the government to have better benefits instead of cutting back what we already have?
Well, that's a very good question. And certainly we do need to have much better benefits and a more secure safety net, not a less secure safety net, which is, of course, in the direction that, as you're quite right, that we have been going. Shockingly, 34% of men and 41% of women in Canada are working in non-standard employment, that is to say precarious work, part-time, casual, on account self-employed, which is usually basically just a person, in a precarious job working for an employer, but under the guise of not actually being an employee and not therefore getting the benefits, the legal benefits of employment. So we have a huge increase in precarious and part-time employment, and much of the growth in employment when we have small bit of growth after the end of the recession, which I suppose has ended, one of those jobless recoveries. But there has been a little bit of recovery, and it's been mostly in part-time work. So clearly people are in increasingly in a precarious state, and we do need benefits, and we can't rely on unions to provide these. Unions used to be in the heyday of unions, which was we weren't that much more heavily unionized than we are now, but unions were able to bargain those benefits for their workers. And this was never a solution for all workers. One of the things that unions did was they set the bar higher for community standards, so that if unionized workers got certain benefits, then other workers could look to getting those kinds of benefits as well, even if they weren't unionized. And employers eager to avoid unionization would often offer those benefits as a way to avoid having their workers join a union. With the decline in unions and a government that is obviously not pro-labor, we have seen a terrible decline in those things, and it's kind of invisible. If you're not actually in a position where you're applying for unemployment insurance or you're on a disability allowance, then you don't actually notice these things. But the decline has been measurable, and it has been measured, and it's been deep. And women in particular have suffered in all of those categories.
Well, thanks for coming in and talking about this today. It's definitely something we're going to be following and want to continue to talk about in future shows.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to Julie Gard. She's the coordinator of the Labor Studies Program at the University of Manitoba. And you're listening to Mud and Water on CKUW 95.9 FM.